We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at the lunchtime campus Bible study, where it was delivered for university students.
Our society is undergoing considerable moral confusion at the moment. I noticed in the Sydney Morning Herald last Monday there was an article on the myth, exposing the myth of moral neutrality and wrestling with the whole problem that we have in our society, that we want to have a kind of moral-free education system and a value-free political system, but you can't really run a society like that, because as soon as you move to education or politics or business, you must run into ethics, you must run into values, but we have almost no agreed ethics. No agreed values as to what is right or wrong or when, or no even agreed method for arriving at some kinds of morality or ethics. To say that there's no rules, that there is no rhyme, there are no reasons, there's no values, is to put you into a world of absurdity, a nightmarish world of absurdity for that. To perpetuate the idea that the whole universe is purely an accident, and that you are an accident, and that I am an accident, and therefore there is no rhyme or reason in this accident, because the nature and essence of an accident is it just happens. That all of the existence is just a gigantic happening, is to create the nightmare kind of world of Franz Kafka, of Camus, of Sartre. It's to open you up to the theatre of the absurd, and to say that the whole of the world is crazy. I mean, there is nothing left in this life except for self-interest. And the self-interest of my self-interest, of course, can come into radical conflict with your self-interest. I was reading Time magazine, which is giving a rundown of the history of Russia over the last 1,300 years, a couple of thousand years, and it reminded me of Ivan the Terrible, who, when he saw a face that displeased him because he didn't like the look of it, he had the head removed. Now, there is a man, you see, who lives in the world of total self-centeredness, and with the power to do it. That was his character. And that is the world of so many tyrants through this century, from Pol Pot to Stalin to Amin to Hitler. It's all the same from all ranges and varieties of opinions, left or right. It makes no difference, political shade of opinion. A tyrant's a tyrant. But when you give somebody the power to live self-centeredly, then indeed the power corrupts, as we know only so well. And that when you say there are no morals in the end, there's no absolutes, there are no real values that stand in judgment over anybody, then you've got to say that what Pol Pot did in removing one third of the population of Cambodia or Kampuchea was all right. I mean, he got away with it, that's his business, that's okay. What Adolf Hitler did with 6 million Jews, well, he got away with it, and till he came to his grisly end. It really doesn't matter. That is, if all the world is a happening, if it's all one gigantic accident, then Adolf Hitler was an accident. He too was a happening. One that has given rise to any number of movies. He's kept Hollywood going for the last 45 years. And why not? After all, boys will be boys. Steve Turner is an interesting poet who's produced a book, amongst others, called Up to Date. He takes the logic of accidentalism and shows you its absurdity. Here's one of his little poems about love. It's called The Conclusion. My love, she said, that when's all considered, we're only machines. I chained her to my bedroom wall for future use. And she cried. It's good poetry in this book, really. It's full of fascinating insights into the human condition. You see, if you take the logic of what she is saying truly, then what he did was completely appropriate. You chain machines to wall. There's a machine up there on a bench that projects things onto the wall here, and I see it's chained because you can't trust undergraduates. And so if you've got a machine, you chain it to the wall. That's exactly what you do, don't you? But of course, there's something fundamentally wrong in it, isn't it? Machines don't cry.
Relationships with what have a habit of disappointing.
The world without rules, the world without values, the world without rhyme is a world that is a nightmare. An absurd nightmare. But as soon as you bring in values and rules,
that the next...
Then you bring in the world of immorality. And he who brings in the rules tends to bring in hypocrisy. Because humans are very high in principle, but very low in performance. They have great standards that they teach and inflict and impose upon each other, but they have great ability at failing to keep their own standards. We know what we value, what we want the other person to do, we know what ought they do, but we who know these things are the very ones who do the wrong things ourselves. We who criticise others are the ones who are ourselves guilty. I was driving around Centennial Park the other day on the outside Barley Road, and this bloke cut right across in front of me in a fairly large lorry. I decided to let him, on the grounds that might is right, after all. And as I reflected upon my anger that he should drive so badly, I reflected on how many times I also had changed lanes without looking. But so often when you change lanes without looking, the person leans out the window and shakes his fist at you, makes rude gestures, yells and berates you. But frankly, which of us has ever driven a car without changing lanes? Without making that same mistake of changing lanes without looking. I mean, you looked in the rear vision mirror, they weren't there a few minutes ago, and you just don't look at the time, and you've done it yourself, haven't you? And yet, though you have done it yourself, when it happens to you, you feel the moral indignation rise up that you can actually say you shouldn't drive. Where did you get your license? Did you learn in Queensland? Or all kinds of other things that might come to your mind.
Any other thoughts? Yes.
So, in truth, you see, what we tend to do is keep a very low profile on morality. Because anyone who stands for morality, it is so easy to lampoon them, to ridicule them, to scorn them. To scorn them because their ideas actually have no intellectual basis. For you cannot prove a moral value system. You cannot in the end find some intellectual ground in the middle of the world accident that makes sense. You can't link it down into some fundamental truth by which you can say, here it is, this is the outworking of the truth of all the universe, because if the truth of all the universe is an accident, then there are no values. And so intellectually you can always be sent up if you're a moralist. And personally, you'll always be sent up, because even if you're not caught doing the wrong thing, we all know that you do the wrong thing from time to time, because we have done those things ourselves. And we've been caught in that same thing. We come to the third of our studies in Romans. And let me remind you of the arguments so far in Romans. First study, chapter 1, verses 1 to 7, was about experiencing the power of God. You see, the gospel is that Jesus is Christ and Lord. That's what's spelled out in the first two or three verses there for us. And this gospel that Jesus Christ is Lord is the power of God to save people, to save anyone, Jew, Gentile, Greek, barbarian, for anyone. And Paul's own life is a great demonstration of the ability of this gospel, this Christ being, Jesus being Christ and Lord, to save somebody. The second study on verses 118 through to 211 in Romans, the second study was about experiencing God's wrath. That is, the wrath has come justly upon the world that ignores God, that lives the lie and turns to alternatives, idols of any kind. This wrath of God comes partially now upon the whole world, for God gives the whole world over to its own self-centered desire. But it will come finally on the day of wrath, mentioned in chapter 2, verse 5, when we will be judged by the truth individually, not just corporately. Each and every one of us will be judged on the basis of what we have in fact done. And therefore the judgment in the end is going to be impartial. Pick it up, verse 9, there will be chapter 2. There will be trouble and distress for every human being who does evil, first for the Jew, then for the Gentile. But glory and honour and peace for everyone who does good, first for the Jew, then for the Gentile. For God does not show favouritism. Now, it's at this point in the argument that the dilemma of the Jew comes to the forefront. For impartiality in judgment is going to give problems to God's chosen nation, the Jews. Already the Jew-Gentile distinction has been raised back in chapter 1, verse 16. The gospel comes to the Jew and also to the Gentile. And Paul, himself a Jew, has been set aside by God, we're told in verse 5 and verse 13, in order to reach Gentiles. Jews are Jews, Gentiles are everybody else, in case you wonder whether you're a Gentile or not. It's not a gentle It's a Gentile. Some Gentiles are gentle, some aren't gentle. Gentiles are non-Jews. And if you've got a view of the world that you are the chosen race, then everybody else is, well, not as good as you, are they? They're not part of the chosen race. They're the rest. There's the chosen race and the rest. The whole world, from their perspective, was Jewish or the rest. Gentile. And God's people were the Jewish people, and the rest were, well, pagans. In fact, to call a Jew a Gentile was to say that he was a sinner, to say he was a pagan, a barbarian, uncouth, ungodly, to say he was an outcast. The Jews saw circumcision as the sign that he was Jewish. It was a sign of keeping the law of God. The law of God was the contract that covered all of life. You see, when God chose this people, he led them out to his mountain and he signed a contract with them. He gave them their constitution, so to speak, with their Bill of Rights and all the rest of it. He established their constitution, their contract, and that contract covered all of life. Told you how to look after your family, told you how to look after your animals, told you a whole range of things, of clothes to wear and not to wear. It told you how to worship God. It told you everything that's worth having to know in how to live in God's promised land. And that's the whole first five books of the Old Testament. It's called the Law. More specifically, it's Exodus 19 to 23. Even more specifically, you could say it's the 10 words, which we call the 10 Commandments, at the beginning of chapter 20. But it's all the Law. And sometimes the word Law means first five books, Genesis through to Deuteronomy. Sometimes it just means that constitutional document, 19 to 23, sometimes in our language we use it to mean the Ten Commandments. But it's all part of the same deal, God's contract with his chosen people. And the Gentiles, of course, are without God, they're without hope, they have no contract from God, and they are without the law, and therefore without morality. Now, there's no doubt from the Old Testament that God was on the Jews' side. I mean, who did he rescue out of Egypt? There were many slaves in Egypt, but it was the Israelites he rescued. Who was it that he gave the promised land to? There were many people already living in the promised land, but he just gave over the promised land to his people. Who did he rescue from Sennacherib, but his people? Whom did he appoint an everlasting covenant with, but his king, David, and his family forever? Who did he rescue out of Babylon? God shows favoritism all the way down the track to the Jews. In the history of this fallen world, God keeps showing favoritism to this nation. But on the day of wrath, that's mentioned in chapter 2, verse 5 following, God does not show favoritism. Where is that going to leave the Jews? The point of departure then today is the impartiality of the judgment. And verses 12 to 16 spell it out. Today's passage is not hard to understand, but the language is very concise. He's packed an enormous amount of argument into the passage that we're going to be looking at. So let's just unpack it. You will need to put your eye onto the passage to see what's being said. You see, he says, if you sin without the law, it's still sin, and you'll perish without the law. And if you sin under the law, well, then you're going to be judged by the law. But the key issue is not whether you have a copy of the law or not. The key issue is whether you sin or not. It's not those who hear the law that are righteous in God's sight, but those who obey the law that are righteous in God's sight. The character of righteousness is not owning a copy, but doing what it says. Now he illustrates it further by saying, well, look, you take the Gentiles. They haven't got the law, but sometimes they do the right thing. I mean, by random chance, they have to eventually, don't they? Can't consistently only ever do the wrong thing. But sometimes they do the right thing even from their good heart. That is, they have shown that the law, which you own a copy of, is actually written on their hearts, written on their consciences, or whatever you want to call it. They know the right thing to do, even though they do not know the law, which says it is the right thing to do. And when they do the right thing, because it's on their conscience to do the right thing, well then, they indeed deserve to be blessed for it. And when you do the wrong thing, even though you know you have a copy of it, well then you deserve to be condemned for it. Now, this actually raises some very important questions about the nature of the law and morality in the universe. For it shows in part what we would know elsewhere, that the law is not arbitrary. That if God didn't sit down one day and say, well, let's make up a few rules here. You shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery, you shall steal, you shall not... Yeah, that'd be a much more interesting world. Let's have it, you shall steal, shall we? And And a little bit of coveting. Well, that'll do, because we've got to keep Wall Street in business. And so, yeah, we'll have that as well. And it's not arbitrary. The law reflects the character of God, just as the created universe reflects the character of God. And so as the law and the universe reflect the character of God, then we who are made in his image, from time to time, will understand what is the character of God, and that this is right, and that that is wrong. And so nearly all law codes will see murder as wrong. It may excuse the king or the Ivan the Terrible, but it will see that this is a wrong thing. That will actually institute some sense of private property with a clause about not stealing and so forth. That is, that the Gentiles can know intuitively, in part, not perfectly by any sense, the idea that there is a thing called fair and just and right. It's been fascinating of recent times to hear people like the late Lionel Murphy, who is so dead set against God, talking about the concept of natural law. How can there be natural law? I mean, if the whole of nature is an accident, then natural law is accidentalism. That's the only law of nature. It just happens. Where do you get natural law from? You get it from your heart. That's where you get it from, because you know in the bottom line there is a thing called what? There is a thing called wrong. There is a thing called fair and unfair. But how can you know that unless the creator of the universe has written his character into the very creation and written his character into your heart? The doctrine of natural justice is another one of those bits where suppressing the truth doesn't work. It's like the bit I mentioned to you last week with Bob Hawke. Oh, I must get some anti-Liberal Party people recently, otherwise you'll think I'm only anti-Labor Party, which is not the case. You see it with Bob Hawke, who wants to rightly say racism is wrong, but he has no grounds for doing it except what his father taught him, namely that God is the father of all mankind and therefore all mankind are brothers.
17, don't you?
That's the only thing he can do. But for an atheist, that's a very silly place to be, like, isn't it? To actually base your morality on God.
But they may all be one.
How can you do that if you don't believe in God? Well, before an election, all kinds of things are possible. Now again, notice how the Bible accurately perceives us. We don't have a rational basis for morality. We don't have all the details of morality. But we still have the sense of morality, that it's got to be there. And so verse 16 says that this will take place on the day when God will judge men's secrets through Jesus Christ, as my gospel declares. There will be a day of judgment, and God will hold all people accountable. And the gospel includes the idea of judgment. The genuine gospel, a gospel without judgment, is not the gospel of the apostles. Now that view of impartial judgment, you see, is the Jewish dilemma. Because the Jew is so inconsistent, as verses 17 to 24 spell out. The Jew is inconsistent like the rest of us, I may say. But he is particularly inconsistent because he has so much to boast about. So much to brag about. He brags about, of all things, verse 23, the law. But his boast is very great. Pick it up where we go, verse 17. Now you, if you call yourself a Jew, if you rely on the law, brag about your relationship to God. You know his will, approve of what is superior, because you're instructed by the law. If you are convinced that you are a guide for the blind, a light for those who are in dark, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of infants, because you have in the law the embodiment of knowledge and truth. See, the Jew has the law. And because he has the law which expresses his relationship with God, he knows the truth. The Gentiles don't know the truth. He is in the light. The Gentiles are in the dark. He can instruct and teach them the ways of God. He is in the receipt of the information and the knowledge of God. And so he brags about his place. But he doesn't practice what the law says. Verse 21, you then who teach others, do you not teach yourself? You who preach against stealing, do you steal? You who say that people should not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? It's always the problem with a moralist. Always the problem who wants to tell people right and wrong, but his own performance doesn't match up to what he preaches. Hypocrisy is the essence of all moralists. It's so easy to point the finger. We don't know what it means about the robbing of temples precisely. We've got several theories as to when and how the Jews were robbing temples. But it was showing the same inconsistency. That's the point of the argument, if we don't know the exact illustration Paul had in mind. And so the judgment is not the judgment of Paul or even of Christians. It's the judgment of the Old Testament, verse 24, as it is written, God's name is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. That is, people of the ancient world looked at the Jews and they said, the God of Israel is not much. Why did they say that? Well, because the God of Israel punished the Jews for their failure to keep the law, sent them off into captivity in Babylon, allowed the Assyrians to destroy most of them. Why did God do that? Because the Jews didn't keep the law. So all the nations despised the God of Israel because God of Israel couldn't look after his own people. God of Israel could look after his own people. He was looking after his own people when he was punishing them for their failure to keep the law. Their failure led to God's name being blasphemed. And so the quote comes to us from a mixture of Isaiah 52:5 and Ezekiel 36:22. Ezekiel 36:22, Isaiah 52:5. It's the inconsistency of all moralists that's brought home to the Jews that if God is going to judge impartially, then he must condemn them for what they have done. However, Paul advances the point further by raising the question of the genuine Jew. What is the real Jew? You see, you call yourself a Jew, but you fail to live as a Jew. What is a Jew? Circumcision was the sign of being Jewish, but anybody could be circumcised. That doesn't necessarily make you a Jew. It's always been a problem for the Jew to define what is a Jew. Even today, if you care to ask some Jewish friends here on university campus, you'll find that they have great difficulty of defining a Jew. You would think it was simple, wouldn't you? I mean, the definition they'll give you straight away is someone who has a Jewish mother. You only have to ask one question and you'll see their confusion. You say, well, what happens if you've got a Jewish mother and you become a Muslim? Are you still a Jew? Can you be a Jewish Muslim? And the answer is no. You can't be a Jewish Muslim. Well, if you can't be a Jewish Muslim, then it's got not to do with whether your mother's Jewish or not, is it? In fact, you could be an Arab and become a Jew, even though your mother wasn't Jewish. You can become Jewish without a Jewish mother, and you can lose Jewishness, even though you've got a Jewish mother. So having a Jewish mother is not the key. Well, then what is being a Jewish? There's no set rules and values. There's no set theology. There's just a solidarity with the Jewish people, which is very hard to define. In fact, the state of Israel has had terrible trouble trying to define its citizenship in this particular area. Circumcision was the sign of being Jewish. But as an external sign, it's not the essence of true Judaism. The essence of true Judaism to Paul is keeping the law. Whether you're circumcised, which is the sign of being under the law, or not, is an irrelevance. It's whether you keep the law, which really matters. It's like wearing a T-shirt, a sloppy Joe, with a university sticker on it. I mean, I've got all number of these people keep giving them to me, and I'm very glad they give them to me. Save me buying things down the street. And I haven't bought a shirt for years, which understands why I wear the kinds of shirts I do. You now understand. Now, I've been given any number of sloppy joes with University of Princeton, University of Oxford, University of Western Australia, all these kinds of things. And I wear them around the streets, and people say, oh, do you study there? Study there? I've never even been there. That I'm wearing a T-shirt like that just means that I've got a mother-in-law or an uncle or an aunt, a brother, a cousin or some far distant relative or friend who happened to pass through the shop at the time and thought, oh, I must buy Philip one of those shirts. And so they buy them for me. Very kind, I'm not knocking it. But wearing the shirt has got nothing to do with being a student at the place, has it? Nothing to do whatsoever. In fact, you can even be enrolled at the University of New South Wales, can't you? So that you wear the shirt, University of New South Wales, and when asked, you produce your card that shows you are an enrolled member of the university. But you still may not study here. And therefore, you're still not a student here, are you? You happen to attend occasionally, well, at least at the enrolment. In fact, that was so long, it felt like a whole degree was deserved to be awarded at the end of it. To be a student at the University of New South Wales requires you to study at the University of New South Wales. Indeed, somebody who studies here but hasn't got a sweatshirt that says they do is much more a student of the university than somebody who wears the sweatshirt and never studies. Well, it's like that with Judaism. Circumcision has some value if you observe the law. But if you break the law, well, then you've become as if you're not circumcised. If those who are not circumcised keep the law's requirements, will they not be regarded as though they were circumcised? See, if you do the study, well, then you're a student, irrespective of what your outside is saying. And so, when is a man a true Jew, verse 28? A man is not a Jew if he's only one outwardly. Nor is circumcision merely outward and physical. No, a man is a Jew if he is one inwardly. And the circumcision is the circumcision of the heart. That is the sign of being a true one. It's done by the Spirit. That is the sign of really being one of God's people. And so, such a man's praise is not from men, but from God. Now, there is a pun there that you can't translate into English. That is, the word praise, the Hebrew word praise, is Judah. And Judah is the basis upon which you get to call people Jews. Jew is just a shorthand way of saying Judah. And so your status as a Jew is not from men, but from God. Your praise is not from men, but from God. It's a pun. I'm sorry if you can't see it as a funny pun. You're having trouble even understanding it as a pun, but that's what it is. It's one of those puns. But I can't see how you could possibly translate it. I mean, such a man's Judah is not from men, but from God. It really doesn't help you all that much, does it? Now, but might? I'll write to the NIV committee. That's what's being meant by it, that you are the genuine Jew. Your praise will be... It's like that throughout the Bible. That is, man looks on the outside, but God on the heart. We are very interested in the externals, whereas God is interested in the truth, in the reality, in the internal, in the motive, in the person themselves. God doesn't pass judgment as we pass judgment just on what we can see. God passes judgment on the basis of what is in fact the truth. When I was a small child, I was taught the story of David and his selection by King Saul, by Samuel rather, to replace Saul. And you remember the story. It's got what I thought as a child was the most beautiful verse I'd ever heard of the Bible. I mean, I hadn't analysed verses much, but it just was a ring of truth about it. And I just said, yes, that is right. If that is what God is like, that is what I want. It is absolutely right. I don't know how old I was as a child, but I remember as a child, and I remember it was part of the early fascination of Christianity for me that it was just so true. Because Samuel looks at the brothers of David, the sons of Jesse, and the first one comes out and he's big and tall and handsome, and Samuel says, this must be the one who is to be king. And God said, no, no, he is not the one to be king, because you mustn't judge as man judges. Man judges on the outside, but God judges by the heart. And so the second son was brought in, and the third, and the fourth, until in the end there were no sons left, except David, who was out looking after the sheep, and they brought him in. And this was the man after God's own heart. This was the man of God's choice. This was the man that pleased God. And the idea that you are judged not by what you put on the outside, but by what is in fact you, immediately appeal to me as being right, as being true, as being fair, as being the way it should be. And that's why I know it appeals to you too. Then I grew up, and when I grew up I worked out that it's the most appalling verse in the whole Bible. I don't think I know any verse that's really worse than that. You see, because I can con people by putting extra things on the outside. I can wear a uniform, I can wear built-up shoes, I can part my hair differently, I can clean my teeth, I can put on a good image. And therefore, I can get away with what I'm really like. But if I'm going to be judged by what is on my heart, then I can't get away with what I'm really like. That is awful. I prefer to be judged on the outside.
Yes.
Because of what really is on my inside. Now, I'd like to say, well, that's just me. You know, I mean, I'm more wicked than you, and therefore I know myself. And, you know, you can still get a good pass mark on your insides. Except what this passage goes on to tell me is that I'm not Robinson Crusoe, that you're in exactly the same position. So let me go and show how it does it. For the genuineness leads to the Jewish excuses of verses 1 to 8. And this is part of the silliest part of the whole Bible. Well, the answers are not silly, the Bible gives, but the arguments are very silly. You see, if this is the truth, then what's the advantage of being a Jew at all, verse 1? What advantage then? We haven't read this section, I know. What advantage, then, is there in being a Jew? Or what value is there in circumcision? The answer? None at all, you would expect. But no, the answer is much in every way. What's the advantage of being Jew? Whether I'm circumcised or uncircumcised doesn't matter. Whether I keep the law is all that matters. What advantage is there in being Jew? Well, the advantage is that you have the law. That you are not left in the dark, knowing that there is a truth, but not knowing what the truth is in detail. You know what the truth is in detail. There's a tremendous advantage in being Jewish, in having the law, because you have been entrusted with the very words of God. The word entrust is exactly the same word as faith. So let me continue reading. What if some did not have trustworthiness? You have been enfaced with the Bible. What if some were not faithful? Will their lack of faith nullify God's faithfulness? You see, I've been entrusted with the law, with the contract. Here's the contract. You keep your side, says God. I don't keep my side. Does that mean God doesn't keep his side? No, not at all. God will be faithful. Let God be true and every man a liar, as it is written, so that you may be proved right when you speak and prevail when you judge. See, I don't keep my side as a Jew, speaking as a Jew. I don't keep my side of the contract. Will God still keep his side? Yes. And by him keeping his side, he will just show how righteous he is. Now comes one of the most stupid arguments you've ever heard. But if our unrighteousness brings out God's righteousness more clearly, what shall we say, that God is unjust in bringing his wrath on us? So I'm using a human argument, that is a stupid argument. You see, if my being unrighteous goes to show just how righteous God is, why is he angry with me? I'm doing him a good turn, aren't I? That is a fundamentally stupid argument, isn't it? But it's the kind of argument of a desperate person who's trying to avoid the wrath of God. Certainly not. If that were so, how could God judge the world? Someone might argue, if my falsehood enhances God's truthfulness and so increases his glory, why am I still condemned as a sinner? That's the same argument again, you see. Why not say, as we're being slanderously reported as saying, and as some claim that we say, let us do evil that good may result. Well, the argument he uses against that is, go to hell. Now, politely put in the NIV, their condemnation is deserved. Basically, go to hell. I mean, it's a stupid argument. It was said of Rasputin, the Russian monk of the early 20th century who had the Tsarina under his control, that he used to preach the gospel which said, you cannot be forgiven unless you sin. So come, let's sin. Now, at that point, it's just so perverse. It was said of Rasputin, the Russian monk of the early 20th century who had the Tsarina under his control, that he used to preach the gospel which said, you cannot be forgiven unless you sin. So come, let's sin. Now, at that point, it's just so perverse, you want to just say, go to hell. And I mean, there's no way you can argue with someone who's saying black is white. And that's the level that they are driven to. God is faithful to his word and will punish, and his righteousness will be demonstrated in punishing those who had the law but didn't keep it. And so we come to the real situation of verses 9 to 20. Is there any advantage, verse 1? Yes. Are we better off, verse 9? No. There's tremendous advantage in having the law of God. But the heart of man is the same everywhere. For all are under sin. That's what we've already said and argued, verses 1:18 through to 2:29. Jew and Gentile, all and everyone is under sin. That rebellion against God that is almost personified here. We're all under the control of it. We're all under the power of it. We think that we can be neutral. We can reject God and live in a neutral world. But when we reject God, we live in a sinful world. We are part of the lie. We are part of the universal cosmic conspiracy against God. It may manifest itself differently with different ones of us. Some of us steal and some of us are proud. Some are full of envy and some hatred. Some are full of jealousy. But it's all the same. It may be that we violently hate God. It may be that we deliberately disobey God. It may be just we ignore God. But it's still the same. The sins that we do, the individual sins, they are only symptoms of this fundamental disease of rebellion against him. I tell a lie. What is the lie? Give me a lie that I picked on Tuesday. Oh, yes. I don't do my assignment And so I've got the deadline, and I go to the lecturer and say, can I have an extension, because my grandmother died, yes, the same one that died last year and the year before, but can I need an extension because, well, the television's been good lately and I'm an addict, so can I have an week's extension? So I tell this lie. Now, when I'm doing it, I don't think about God one way or another. But in effect, what I'm doing is rebelling against God. God says he hates lies. Lying lips are an abomination to him, but he is truth himself. And he wants us to live in truth. That's what God says. And what I'm saying is, well, look, God, you've never been late with an assignment. You don't know what it's like to be a TV addict. You don't know how fierce my lecturer is. You don't know how to handle the situation that I am in. And I know how to handle it. Your way of handling it, that's a stupid way. Tell the truth, I'll fail. That's a stupid way. I'll do it my way. That is, I'll tell the lie. Now, I don't go through that mental process of thinking about God when I'm doing it. But in effect, what I'm doing is saying God's way is not my way. I'll run my life my way, because God says, tell the truth. Very simple, very obvious for us. We are all caught in this pattern, all under the power of it. And so there's a series of Old Testament quotations given to us there about the scriptures charging us as being sinful. As it is written, I haven't read verse 9. What shall we conclude? Are we better off? Not at all. We've already made the charge that Jews and Gentiles all alike are under sin. As it is written, there is no one righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands, no one who seeks God. All have turned away. They have together become worthless. There is no one who does good, not even one. I think he's trying to say something, don't you? Right? That there are no excuses. There are no clauses here. It's all of us. Their throats are open graves. Their tongues practice deceit. The poison of vipers is on their lips. Their mouths are full of cursing and bitterness. They are swift to shed blood. Their ruin and misery mark their ways. And the way of peace they do not know. There is no fear of God before their eyes. The footnotes of your Bibles will tell you where those different quotations come from. The book of Psalms 14, 5, 140, 10, Isaiah 59 and Psalm 36. Some of them are specifically on Israel, such as the one in Isaiah 59, which is quoted in verse 13, in verse 15, 16, 17. Some of them are on all mankind. But what it is saying that Jew and Gentile alike is given over in the law, in the scriptures, as being under sin. And so the verdict of the law on us is guilty. Now we know, verse 19, that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be silenced and the whole world held accountable to God. Therefore, no one will be declared righteous in his sight, by observing the law. Rather, through the law, we become conscious of sin. The law is for the Jews, who think they're superior, but the Jewish law says that you are guilty. All the world is guilty. No one is righteous by observing the law. What the law does is it leads you to consciousness of sin. It leads you to condemnation. What the law doesn't do is save you. I give you some commandments. You shall not lie. You shall not steal. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not be greedy. You shall not be envious. You shall not covet. I've given you commandments. Now, will those commandments save you? No. What those commandments do is they teach you what sin is. And they teach you that you are sinful. What they do is they declare your condemnation. The law has no power for salvation. The law's power is for condemnation, and therefore it's radically different for the gospel. Australians don't understand this, by the way. Australians still think that Christianity is all about the Ten Commandments and keeping the law. But this passage is saying, you can't say it more explicitly than verse 20, that the verdict of the law is condemnation, not salvation. These three chapters then give us a great picture of ourselves. They spell out the nature of sin, of our sin and of our nature. For we know there is a God, but we do not worship him as God. We want to play God ourselves. We suppress the truth and look for alternatives. But the lies don't make sense, and the life they lead to is fruitless. All this is natural to us. Secondly, we discover that it's natural to all of us, because there's a universality in this sin. The world, you see, is not made up of the good guys and the bad guys, the blokes in black and the blokes in white, the ones with moustaches, the ones without. It's not like that. The world is made up of us. all of us who by nature are rebellious against God, who by nature are living out a lie, who by nature are living self-centeredly. And so I mustn't blame the mess the world is in on the politicians, or the foreigners, or the tyrants, or on the system, or on Wall Street, or on the structures, or on the education department. You can change all those things, but you won't change the mess the world is in, because the world is messed up by millions and millions of people like you and me, who are living the lie that we are God. It's a mess because the whole world is made up of us. A system like capitalism is brilliant because it recognises the sinfulness of man and builds upon it. A system of socialism is brilliant because it recognises that people should be treated fairly and justly. But unfortunately, in its idealism, it doesn't understand how sinful people are, and therefore it never works. It's the character of the world we're in. A couple of years ago, I was down at Bronte Beach on a night in which the rainbow people were holding a great celebration because all the stars were in the right accord, you see, so the whole universe was in harmony for just 10 minutes or so, and therefore they were all in harmony and they were down there harmoniously making rainbow noises and making all kinds of things, you see, down on the beach. And I was fascinated because as I drove around there watching them all arriving, I noticed that every one of them that got out of the car locked the door. So harmonious with human relationships that they had to lock their cars to keep the thieves out. It's like the litter at the end of an environmentalist demonstration. The university, friends, always censors out this doctrine of sin from classroom discussion. It always must, you see, because the doctrine of sin requires you to have an absolute. It requires you to have God. Now, you're not allowed to have God in the classroom, therefore you can't have sin in the classroom. So you sit down in general studies or in the humanities to discuss human nature, to discuss the character of history or whatever it is, but you're not allowed to mention the one thing that is true of all humans, and that we're sinful. I remember doing an essay at school just after I'd become a Christian on the subject of the causes of the Rum Rebellion, and I wrote down that the causes really were Adam and Eve. It was the lowest mark I ever received on any history assignment. You see, I was right, and the history teacher was wrong. The kinds of causes he were interested in were only trivial and trifling. The real cause in the end lay in humanity's wickedness. But you're not allowed to say it, friends. Censorship is alive and well in our world. Which comes to clarifying then the confusion of morality. For certainly there are values, there are rights and wrongs in this world. There is justice and there is truth. The Lord declares it. But it also declares our failure, our immorality, our condemnation. Without values, the world is a meaningless nightmare. With values, the world is a wicked place, condemned and not saved. But that really tells us that our divine standing is lostness. We are under the wrath of God, under the judgment and condemnation of God. And that is the case. All of us. Who is going to be saved? None of us. Well, some are. But that's what the next paragraph's about. And so that's what next week is about. And that's why you need to be back with us to hear about it. Can I ask you, fill out cards if you haven't written already in these things. Write the questions and comments you like. I will read each one of them. But they need to go in the boxes that will stand beside the doors here. So do drop them in the boxes that our staff members will be holding down here in 2 seconds. Let's pray, shall we? We thank and praise you, Father, for your judgment upon us and its righteousness, and we pray that you would help us not to get rid of values for the sake of our unrighteousness, but to find your gospel truth by which we can be saved. And we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.